Well, again, good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. It is quite an honor that you would have me come here to speak with you, representing your respective churches. Again, just a little bit of background on me. I was a practicing attorney. I grew up in Burbank, went to Burbank High School, went to UCLA, went to University of San Diego for law school. I practiced as an attorney from 1989 until 2007. Over that time, my work was in civil litigation, which meant typically that people who were much richer than I ever hoped to be were fighting over money. And I was involved in the middle of it. Oftentimes it was with companies or such. And so I was a business attorney. I represented companies. I did various kinds of litigation involving contracts and pieces of property and intellectual property. And I also was a teacher at Master's College. I taught law at the college for a number of years. In 2007, I went from my position being full-time as an attorney to being a pastor at Calvary Bible Church in Burbank, where I'm a pastor of adult ministries. And I also teach out at Master's College. I teach theology and various classes in biblical counseling. So I've had some experience with these things from the perspective of the law side of it, because issues involving discrimination, such were things that would come up in the context of legal proceedings. I've had interactions with various churches about this issue and about what sorts of things can a church do to properly protect itself, because there are legal ramifications of the change taking place with respect to sexual ethics in the United States. And it's come up quite a bit in the course of doing counseling or pastoral work. So I've had to see it from a number of different places. This morning, what I want to do is this. I want to talk about homosexuality, but I want to put it in a larger context than just thinking about homosexuality as an isolated target. Let me give you an example. If you've ever had a leaky roof, it's rained and the rain comes down one place. Okay. Now, if you went straight up from where the drops coming down, you would not find the hole in your ceiling. Because almost always the hole is 3-4 feet over to the side, and then the water comes down and it runs along a beam, and for some reason it comes out in this other place. So if you try to fix directly above where you see the water coming down, you will almost certainly end up in the wrong part of the roof. If you think about this question of homosexuality as just like a straight, if that's the drop coming down, if you would go straight up to the roof and look there above and up into the sky, you wouldn't find where the problem is. The question about homosexuality is not an isolated issue. It's part of something much larger that's taking place in the culture. The reason why we have gotten here is not because homosexuality is completely novel, but rather because it's part and parcel of something larger that's taken place. If you spend all of your time trying to think about this in isolation, you're going to miss the point of what's going on here. So I want you to see some of the bigger picture of what's involved with respect to homosexuality becoming such a cultural issue. In addition to that, I want you to not just understand how to respond in terms of intellectual arguments or even legal responses. I want you also to understand how to respond in terms of the individual men and women who will come to our congregations, and how do we respond to them, and how do we care for them? How do we think about this? Because the young man who comes up to you and says to you when he's 17, I'm having problems with the fact that I'm attracted to other men sexually and I don't know what to do about this, isn't a member of some monster conspiracy. There's no agenda there. It's a simple situation of sexual temptation like any of the other young men who have come to speak to you. So I want you to think about responding to homosexuality first in terms of what is it as the large cultural setting, but also how to respond to the individuals and how to distinguish between those two things. Because if the 17-year-old comes into you and you launch into a complex discussion about how Western culture has ended up in this place, you're going to do him no good, and you're going to have done yourself no good, and even more importantly, you're going to have done the gospel's proclamation no good. Because at the end of the day, the thing that's really hopeful here is what the gospel can say to the situation. I want to begin this morning with reading you a letter. This was a letter that was published by Rod Dreyer. Rod Dreyer is a political, cultural columnist. He's a Christian from everything I can see. And he wrote this. I received a terrific letter from a reader last night. Quote, "As a millennial whose change of heart on gay rights, same-sex marriage played a significant role in my walking away from the faith of my childhood, I feel I can shed a little light on that dynamic, and specifically why millennials aren't moving on to more liberal churches. My leaving was much more about what the gay rights issues revealed about that faith than it was about the actual issue of gays and their rights to marry. Because there is nothing more obnoxious than a 24-year-old who's going to tell everyone how the world works. How the world works. All of this comes with a major caveat that it is simply my experience and perhaps no one else's. I grew up in a Baptist church which practiced a kind of soft evangelicalism. They would never have thrown out that term because doing that kind of taxonomy isn't really what the Baptist mindset, but the influence of evangelicalism was everywhere. Even for non-evangelical millennials, though, it's important to remember just how much evangelical culture infused the culture of youth groups from more traditional denominations during this period. I spent a fair amount of time in other churches, and even in those churches that were quite conventional with their adult ministries, their youth ministry was heavily influenced by evangelicalism. We were taught that our church not only had the absolute truth, but that there was no earthly history between the Bible and the doctrines being presented to us. I went to evangelical churches 52 Sundays a year for the better part of 19 years, and I cannot for the life of me remember once when the name of a theologian was mentioned. There was one interpretation of Scripture, and it was absolutely true. In fact, even the various doctrines that were taught were never mentioned by name because the presence of the name might suggest that there were alternatives. One in three sermons at least name-check pre-tribulation rapture theology, but neither those terms nor premillennialism nor John Nelson Darby was ever mentioned. Instead of an intellectual tradition, it was a church built on emotion. Every sermon is a revival stump speech about the evils of the world and the need for salvation. Every sermon ended in a sentimental pop worship chorus to accompany an altar call in which the same handful of members weeps at the altar. These people are subsequently held up as the most exemplary Christians. I had a friend in junior high who could cry on cue. She cleaned up on the attention system. The problems these churches inevitably ran into with their young members and same-sex marriages on the issue of doubt. When you have a feeling-based salvation in a faith in which doubt is a sign of spiritual failure, the young members of these churches lack the space to wrestle with tough issues like this. You can see same-sex marriage advocates as employing emotive arguments in order to win, but you have to realize that a lot of Christians are being argued against, have traded in nothing but emotion for the last 30 years. Salvation is a weeping, sinner's prayer, mumbling, emotional roller coaster, and the emoting never stops. In all the years I was a member, my evangelical church made exactly one argument about same-sex marriage. It's the argument I like to call the argument from ickiness. And I do want to underscore this point right here. One of the reasons that homosexuality has shown up as a problem in our church is because we finally got to the place where in the church's response to sexual sin, it started to feel icky. Remember I was using the example earlier of the rain coming from the roof? The water's been coming from the roof for years and years and years, and we just haven't paid attention. It just started to come down in a place that particularly bothered us. That's one of the reasons that homosexuality has become a problem. It's one that feels particularly icky to us, if you will. It seemed to be the line, even the culture that we all grew up in. You know, I'm 52 years old now. I was born in 1962 in California. In 1962 in California, it was a crime to be a homosexual. Now it's a constitutionally protected right to be a homosexual. Something has happened there. It caught our attention because that was something everybody knew was over the line when I was growing up. Even in 2008, the president said that he was against same-sex marriage when he ran for president. So something very dramatic has taken place in terms of what it looks like. And if to use that metaphor, it's sort of like the water's been coming down elsewhere in the house, and it finally started to hit me on the couch. And I looked up and I noticed that the water is coming through, but the water's been coming through everywhere. And so the problem here that he brings up about the argument from ickiness is a rather important one. This is also very important too when it comes to how you respond to individual men and women in your congregations on the issue of homosexuality. I have a friend of mine, a young man in the church, who's very involved, and his besetting temptation is same-sex attraction. One of the things that makes it very difficult for him is if he's in a men's small group, all the guys go around and all of the men can talk about where they are being tempted sexually to sin, and he's the one man who can't say, by the way, this is a temptation. I'm having a really hard time here. Can you pray for me? Because he's concerned that the other men are going to look at him and go, ah, that's disgusting. Number of men with whom I've done biblical counseling on this issue gave very much the same story. 17 years old, I'm 18, I'm 16. I start to notice that all the other boys in my high school are being overly sexually attracted to women. I'm finding myself being sexually attracted to men. They can sit in my high school small group and say, I'm having a really hard time. I looked at pornography last week. And I'm the one who can't say, I'm having a really hard time. I looked at the guys in the locker room last week. Well, that's just too icky. So what the young men would do would be, they would struggle in quiet. They would struggle in silence. Rather than being able to utilize the resources of the church, like everyone else, they found themselves going, I have the sin that's over the line. This is the one that's too icky. We can't talk about it. So when he turns 24, he finally says, forget it. I can't be a Christian. I must not be good enough. And he goes out and he throws himself out into the world. Oftentimes these men have, I'd say in a number of cases, the men actually are Christians. They go out, they plunge themselves into sin, and they're horrified to see what they're doing with it because they rightly have a conviction over this. They then feel so guilty that they don't know if they can go to church or not, and so they sit in the back and they're kind of on the fringes of their congregation. The other place that this really is going to show up is going to be when somebody in your church comes up to you and says, my nephew is a homosexual and he's getting married and I love him dearly and I want to go to his marriage. And you go, well, homosexuality is icky and it's a sin. And she goes, but so is living together. And you didn't say it was wrong for me to go to the marriage of my niece who was living with her boyfriend for 4 years and even had a kid. That was okay. Well, why is this sexual sin such that I can't go to his wedding, but I could go to my niece's wedding? How are you distinguishing between these two things? And if our argument is, it's really disgusting to be a homosexual, you have failed in your position as a pastor. And the reason why we've failed is sort of what this young man is bringing up here, that most of the time we've thought this issue through no further than it's icky and I don't want to talk about it. It's just that's the one that bothers me the most. I'm going to continue with this letter. Being gay is icky, and the people who are gay are the worst kind of sinner you can be. Done. Amen. Pass the casserole. When you have membership with no theological or doctrinal depth that you have neglected to equip with the tools to wrestle with hard issues, the moment ickiness no longer rings true with young believers, their faith is destroyed. This is why other young ex-evangelicals I know point as this their turning point on gay marriage to the moment they first really got to know someone who was gay. If your belief on same-sex marriage is based on the learned disgust at the thought of a gay person, the moment a gay person, any gay person, ceases to disgust you, you have nothing left. In short, the anti-same-sex marriage side and the really Christian side of the culture war in general is responsible for its own collapse. It failed to train up the young people on its own side, preferring instead to harness their energy while providing them no doctrinal depth by keeping them in a bubble of emotional dependence on their never engaging with the outside world on anything but warlike terms. Perhaps someday my fellow ex-evangelical millennials and I will join other churches, but it will be essentially new Christians with no religious heritage from our childhoods to fall back on. That is absolutely the nature of the problem that we are facing. He could not be more correct in what the difficulty is. Yes, sexual sin is serious. And I want to say something in all earnestness. I detest what I've seen homosexuality do to men and women. But like all sexual immorality, it's essentially destructive, first and foremost, to the person who engages in it. When we see someone caught up in the sin, we should have great compassion for that person when we realize the degree of damage which has gone on to them. I know it's anecdotal evidence, and it's because it's based upon my own experience, and this isn't a massive survey that I've done with... I need to move this. Every homosexual man and woman in the country. But one of the things that I've noticed very often is these people come in and the effect of sexual immorality on their life, and this is the case of all sexual immorality, it just becomes more acute with same-sex attraction, is that it's damaged their capacity to form appropriate relationships with people. You know, one of the reasons that God gave us human sexuality is because it creates a method for us to attach to people. In particular, it allows for a man and a woman to have a very close bond in the context of a covenant of marriage for the purpose of learning what it is for God to say that He loves His people. When you take that sexuality and you move it outside of the covenant context, the effect of it is that you have now joined in all of these very intimate unions with human beings without real intimacy. You begin to break the mechanisms which God has given us for the purpose of forming appropriate relationships. What happens in particular with same-sex attraction is that you've damaged the capacity for friendship all the way around. I'll explain to you what I mean. If I were to go out with any of you men here, George and I are going to go on a camping trip this weekend. We're going to go hiking up in the Sierras. We're going to be gone for 3 days. No one here would think a thing of that. If I were to go on a camping trip for 3 days in the Sierras with George's wife, or he were to go with my wife, assuming our spouses didn't kill us before that happened, you would all rightly think something was wrong. You see, the taboo, the forbidding sexual relationships between men and men or women and women permit men and men or women and women from forming extremely close friendships. David and Jonathan could have the most intimate of relationships because it could not possibly be a sexual relationship. Forbidding the sexuality in those contexts gives freedom for friendship and fellowship to take place. With men and women who have found themselves involved in same-sex relationships for years, they've destroyed the capacity to form appropriate friendships. One of the things that I've had to do most when I've done counseling with men in these situations is simply be friends with them, because they need to get to learn how to be a man's friend without sexualizing that relationship. When God forbade us sexuality in certain places, He did it for our good and for our intimacy because He loves us. All right? Now, I want you to see how deeply ingrained this is and the effects of it. So we're going to take a look at Romans 1, and we're going to take a look at Genesis 1, 2, and 3 briefly. I'm going to begin with a passage in Romans 1. I want you to notice something here. Now, in Romans 1:18, we do know that the wrath of God has been revealed. And then as Paul goes along here, he starts to explain what has gone wrong with humanity. I'm going to start in verse 21. For although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. as you know, down in verse 28, it says that God gave them over to a debased or a reprobate mind. We're going to get back to that. The idea here is something called the noetic effect of sin, the fact that sin affects our ability to think. There's something wrong with our reasoning, our ability to evaluate because of sin. Again, they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Verse 22, claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those which are contrary to nature, and the men, likewise, gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another and committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. Paul here is very deliberately echoing the language of Genesis 1 and also Genesis 3 and a little bit in 2. He's speaking here about the fact of human beings were created for a purpose. Human beings were created for the purpose of worshiping God. It is what is built into the absolute nature of us as human beings. Due to time constraints, I'm not going to be able to develop that whole thesis at length right now. So please just go with me on that one. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to show you more at the break about how that's a true statement of the nature of human beings. But we're created for the purpose of worship. When we disrupted that right worship relationship with the Creator, that desire and capacity for worship immediately flipped over to something else, the creature. And human beings, ever since then, have been busy worshiping and being thankful to the creature rather than to the Creator. That disorder then pervades everything else in our life. We can't think correctly anymore. And therefore, we can't even behave correctly. The desires that we have become disordered as the result of the disorder of sin. Go with me to Genesis 1. I want to show you a couple places of how this appears in the text. Genesis 1, when we get to the creation of humanity, let's go down to verse 25. And God made the beast of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. You remember in Romans 1 where Paul is making reference to the fact that God has created all of these things. And Paul uses very similar language in Romans 1 to this language here about the creation of the various animals in Genesis 1. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image." That's the word Adam. It means human being. It does not mean male as opposed to female because, for instance, in Genesis 5, it says that God created the Adam, Adam. Male and female, he created them. So the idea of humanity is not maleness versus femaleness, but you're going to see that male and female are the aspects of what it is to be a human being. Okay, and let them be after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heaven and over the livestock and over everything that creeps and every creeping thing that creeps on the ground. So God created human beings to be in dominion over these things. Part of being in the image of God is to project God's order and rule over his creation. We were created for this remarkably high standard. It's one of the reasons that human beings are so frustrated in this world. We were created for greatness, but because of our sin, we've been debased. Rather than having dominion over the creation, we're now in a situation where we worship the creation. Continuing on. So God created man in his image, his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air, the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So God creates human beings and he creates in us not just the capacity or the desire for dominion, but he also builds into the actual nature of human beings sexual distinctions, male and female, that goes to the heart of what we are as human beings. So you can see here that same-sex attraction and behaving on this, and same-sex marriage and such, denies something that God has put us into us at the very beginning of us being human beings. It's at the most basic nature, contrary to our nature. Like Paul speaks about in Romans chapter 1, he says they're doing things that are contrary to nature. You look at human beings and you can see that boys and girls are different. You look out over the whole animal kingdom, every kind of animal, every place we look, we see that picture again and again and again. Males and females are different from one another. God gives the human beings a capacity, or a command, excuse me, to be fruitful and multiply. That is something that only comes through males and females being together. It's built into what we are by nature. So when we rebel against that, which is what we're doing with homosexuality and all kinds of sexual perversions, is that we're rebelling against the nature of God. We're rebelling against our creatureliness. We're denying the fact that we have a creator when we do this. One of the arguments that lies behind the whole issue of the sexual revolution that's taking place, and homosexuality in particular, has to do with this concept of nature. Remember I told you that there's the noetic effect of sin. Because of sin coming in, we've become disordered in our ability to think. There's two ways to think about human nature. One of them has been the traditional way that human beings have done throughout the thousands and thousands of years that we have recorded history. And that is, you look and see what human beings are and you draw deductions. You see boys, girls, you see that they're different. You see how anatomically, biologically, emotionally, and just necessarily for the sake of the perpetuation of the species, that these two things belong together when it comes to sexuality. You don't need some sort of special revelation to figure out boys and girls. Every pagan who's lived anywhere, who's never heard a word from the scripture, knows the difference between boys and girls. But there's another way to understand human nature. It's something that came in, it got a lot of currency at least, with the French philosopher Rousseau, which is in the height of the Enlightenment. And what Rousseau says is, no, our nature is not something that is just inherent in us. It's something that we get to decide. In Genesis 2, at the very end of it, you see the basic social structure of humanity is marriage. A family is the basic social unit. Human beings, Adam, is not done until he gets Eve. Correct? Everybody understands that point. Rousseau said, no, the individual is the basic social structure. I am the basic social structure. And since nature is... since the individual is the basic social structure, I get to decide whatever I want to be. I want you to see where this comes in. Go with me to Genesis chapter 3. At the end of Genesis 1, we see it says, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother, and they shall hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed. Then the serpent shows up in the garden. And the serpent says in verse 4, you shall not surely die, for God knows that in the days that you eat of it, the fruit on the tree, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Human beings desired the capacity to determine what is right and wrong. What we desired was this capacity and this ability to be completely and radically, that means down at the very root, autonomous from our creator. We desired to be creatures without a creator. That lies at the heart of the sexual revolution which has taken place in the West over the last few years. That lies in the heart of what's taking place when it comes to homosexuality, the place where we finally really got to see this in very clear colors. It's a radical rebellion against the Creator. It's a denial of our status of being a creature. I get to decide who I am, what I am, and what I'm going to do. You know, you see that now with the further movement that we see taking place, something called transgenderism, right? You've heard about that, where somebody can say what I am as being, as a matter of biology, is completely a matter of my own decision. I get to decide who I am, what I am, and what I will do, and there is no authority over that. Biology doesn't even have authority over whether I am male or female. I saw this brought to one of its logical extremes. I saw this debate that took place on TV, and as I recall, it went like this. There was a black woman and a white man, and the white man was arguing that he was a proud black woman. And the black woman was saying, no, you're not. And he was saying, how can you tell me I'm not? I am a proud black woman. I mean, the man could not get a tan, and he was plainly not a girl. And yet he denied just the physical characteristics of him. He was denying what color his skin was. That was the level of absurdity of this. So you can see that this is really a denial of the fact that I am a creature. You can see in Romans 1 when Paul says, what's the real problem that we have as human beings? We refuse to admit that we are creatures with a creator. And because of that, we can't understand anything else correctly. I mentioned a theologian since that letter said we didn't. The very beginning of John Calvin's Institutes, he makes this brilliant observation. Human beings know nothing about themselves until we begin to see ourselves before God. Everything's out of focus. We can't understand anything until we look at who we are in the light of who God is. And only as we begin to gain an understanding of God can we begin to gain an understanding of who we are in ourselves. When you think about all of the various insanities and sins that take place among human beings, you can very quickly begin to see that those things all flow out of a misunderstanding of what it is to be a creature who has a creator. You know, when we violate the goods of other human beings, you know, any of the things that you would see, for instance, in the Ten Commandments, all of the abuses of relationships, everything from murder to hatred, you realize that human beings are not treating other human beings as having the same status as them. We begin to put ourselves over other human beings, correct? You know, you see that in very grotesque places, like when it comes to different kinds of racism, as if there were actually races. You know, I remember reading about some British killing Aborigines in Australia to put into a museum in Britain because they're obviously not human beings. You start to see this built into the culture. For instance, the 19th century, when Darwinian version of evolution gets a big shot in the arm, they're going to go start looking for primitive human beings. So they go to sub-Saharan Africa because everybody knows that the ones that must be closest to monkeys are black people. Why do you think they started looking there? How did they not know if this was true? Like, why wasn't the most primitive human being in Scandinavia as opposed to the Congo? How could you know that? But you have human beings, one standing over another and denying the fact that we're all creatures before God and that all human beings have intrinsic worth and value because of the fact they are creatures. Sexual immorality degrades both myself and the other human being. Sexual immorality treats other human beings as objects. And what happens then is I'm now treating myself as an object to be used as I see fit, which is what you have then with the various forms of sexual perversion. And the most extreme, obviously, being something like, well, I'm going to deny that I'm even a body. As if our bodies weren't good and they could be moved around. That, incidentally, and as you start to pull in all of the strings here, with the noetic effects of sin, if you will, the different ways that it's twisted up our thinking, you find that it begins to affect everything, and it runs in a million different directions. This particular one, where I say there's a real me that stands over my body, is Gnosticism, which is an ancient heresy that got into the Christian church around the end of the first century and then really blew up in the second century. And that's the idea that there's a real self, a spiritual self, which sits over top of the physical. The physical is bad and evil and can be disregarded. The spiritual self is the real self, and that needs to be freed from the bonds of being a creature. Again, it's a rebellion of being a creature. It's a good thing that we have bodies. It's a lovely thing that we have bodies. It's part of what we are as Christians and what we always are going to be as human beings. The great Christian hope is a resurrection, which is the continuity of our body. Incidentally, in First Corinthians chapter 6, Paul raises the resurrection as one of the arguments against sexual immorality. The bodies that we have are going to be the bodies that we keep forever. Sexual immorality is a direct frontal assault on our status as a creature. It just becomes patently obvious when it comes to the matter of same-sex sexuality. Does that make sense? All right, let me continue on here a little bit. Now, the current status of what is happening in the world with respect to homosexuality has a number of different supports and arguments. I'm going to run over those things very briefly. If you have any questions, we can speak about that more. I believe we're going to have a second session where there's going to be a chance for some questions and answers. So if you want to develop any of these things more at that time, we can. One of them is a philosophical argument that's being made. As I pointed out to you, this is an argument that got its greatest strength in Rousseau. By the way, when we get into this part of it, this is one of the places that you're not going to want to go when the 17-year-old shows up in your office and says, I'm finding myself attracted to other men. He's not going to know this. In fact, most of the people with whom you're speaking are not going to have arguments more complicated than, I really want to do this, and how can something I want to do so badly be wrong? They're going to have heard that that argument is appropriate from the culture. These are the things that are lying behind the fact that the culture got to this place, that the standard wisdom around us is that whatever I want to do is good. Okay? So you don't need to bring up Rousseau when somebody comes into you, but I want you to get an idea about what Rousseau was doing because it'll help you understand what's lying behind the arguments that you're hearing. Rousseau said, rather than nature being what is apparent and what exists, and that it's all going towards some point, at the very least, when you see, if you want to reduce human beings to mere biology, you can see that the point where human sexuality goes is the procreation of children. Now, that's not the only thing that happens with respect to human sexuality. In fact, human beings are unique in that we are the one kind of animal that has the capacity for engaging in sexual relations that does not possibly lead to child-rearing. Human beings are capable of having intimate relations all throughout the time of the relationship between a man and a woman. Animals other than human beings, and by saying animal, I'm not trying to degrade human beings to the level of animal, but I'm saying if you just look at that, you can see this. Most animals are only capable of having relations when the female is in heat, when she's capable of bearing a child. Human beings can't do that because human sexuality is meant for more than just making more human beings. It has a great deal of good in it, and it's extraordinarily powerful. And it teaches us a lot about ourselves and about God. But when you look at human beings, you can see that there's a nature. Rousseau looked at human beings and said, all of those things that you see that human beings do or don't do have been imposed on the human being from the outside. there's some sort of society, some kind of tradition, some kind of culture that's told human beings, you're a boy, you're a girl, you need to act like this. We need to be freed from all of that past. So the reason when you make an argument to somebody and you go, well, this is insane. No human society has ever had homosexual marriage. And the response from the person on the other side would say, well, that's just a failure of imagination. That's just the oppression of society that has imposed itself upon human beings. Those things that you think you see in nature don't really exist. There really isn't a difference between boys and girls. That's all made up. That's just something that's been forced upon us from the outside. Rousseau lets that genie out of the bottle. All throughout the 19th century, that begins to get a lot of currency in different areas. We begin to have this myth of progress. You know, if you look back in the ancient world and you look at all of the various stories and mythologies and cultures human beings have, that there's always a golden age in the past, and what they see is things have been getting worse over the course of time. That's how the Bible sees things. We were originally created for a great place. There's been a fall, and then there's been a decay over the course of time. We can see that in our bodies. Just to give you the most basic example, we all have DNA in our bodies that makes our bodies, gives instructions to our bodies. Our DNA is being corrupted at a massive rate. It's becoming corrupted so quickly that we're not going to be around on the planet for another 100,000 years. Our genes are giving out on us. Our bodies, they not only decay over the course of our own life, but they have been decaying over the course of our entire existence that we've known human beings. You know, take a look at the dates as soon as the flood happens, and you see the drop-off year by year by year. We're not living as long. There was a professor at Stanford, so I'm going to quote somebody who is not a Christian, does not pretend to be a Christian. I have no idea if he's even a theist. Who said that if you were to take the average schmo off the street in Athens, that's 2,400 years ago, and drop him in one of our cities, he'd be smarter and have better mental capacity and emotional capacity than anybody we know now because our genes are decaying so quickly. We're falling apart. But in the 19th century, we begin to have something called the myth of progress. Things are getting better. So, for instance, we have Darwin who says that things breaking creates more complicated things. We begin to have that in economic theory with Marx, and those sorts of understandings then spread out into all these other areas of human analysis. There's a German philosopher, Hegel, who said, this thing contrasts with that thing, which creates a new thing, and so we get movement through history, and there's progress going on. For these people, when it comes to the fact of there never having been homosexual marriage in the history of the world, what these people think is that's because we've progressed more now. We're becoming freed from our culture. We're becoming freed from our society. Does that make sense? All right. So we have this idea of human progress, and this comes largely from Rousseau. It gets help from people like Freud, who said that all the trouble in this world comes from the fact that we're oppressing our sexuality. It shows up in the law. It shows up in culture. It shows up in any number of places. This idea that I do not need to be bound by biology. I do not need to be bound by the culture around me. I do not need to be bound by family. I do not need to be bound by nature. I do not need to be bound by anything. I am the absolute master over everything that pertains to me. Which is exactly what the serpent offered. You get to decide what is right and wrong. So what you're seeing here is that this all has ultimately a theological root. The theological disorder that takes place begins to give rise to poor thinking. We can't think right. We can't understand right. That shows up first and foremost in areas of philosophy, like with Rousseau. It then spreads out into other human areas. It gets traction from the idea of progress. We then come to the 20th century, and you guys have heard of postmodernism, undoubtedly. Very simply, postmodernism means this. It means I have a set of preferences. There are things that I like. And if I like them, they are good, because there is no greater good in my life than the good which comes from fulfilling my desires. All that happens is there are structures which you put up to keep me from getting what I want. I'm allowed to use anything I want to get my desires met. Any kind of argument, any kind of tactic, any kind of argument from fairness or from law or from tradition or whatever I want to see. And the one that most of this has come through is the idea of love. And if you don't give them to me, you're keeping me from this. You see, the perversion here has come to this. Love, the word love, has become the argument which undergirds all of the sexual perversity that we see in the culture. So I want to back up, let you see what I mean in terms of all the parts, because I've known to throw a lot of different things out there and make this clear. When we go back to the very beginning, we were created as creatures under a creator. We were created for the purpose of worshiping God. We were created to have dominion over all of nature, and we were created male and female. We rebelled against that. We said we get to decide what's going to happen, which leads to a number of disorders very quickly. We lose the capacity to think correctly. Our thinking, our hearts become disordered. Our affections, our desires, everything becomes out of place. And we begin to worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. What we have done then is had a history of trying to figure out how to perfect our rebellion against God. How do we rebel against Him ever more effectively? What do we do? Well, we will begin to rebel against Him in denying what we are as human beings. We will worship His creation, and then we'll see that most particularly in our own bodies. Since what we are as human beings is quite plainly sexual beings, and that we are male and female, that will become disordered. Human sexuality, as I said at the beginning, was given to us so that we can understand God rightly and well. One of the ways in which we understand God is that God is love. God gave us human sexuality so that we could begin to understand what it means for a perfect creator to tell his creatures, I love you. He didn't need to give us sexuality in the way that we have it in order for us to reproduce the species, because our sexuality is far stronger than is needed to keep human beings on the planet. Take an example of eating or sleeping, which are also very powerful things for human beings. We rarely find people who are willing to stay in bed for months on end. We rarely find people who will eat to the point that they are physically in pain over and over again. There seems to be some proportion between the desire and the need to perpetuate us as beings. But when it comes to sexuality, it goes far further than that, doesn't it? It becomes one of the most overriding things that occur to human beings. Why did God give us something this powerful? Notice what he says to Israel, and then again we have a New Testament where he speaks of Christ in the church. I'm your husband and I love you. I am jealous for you. Isn't that what God says to Israel? The book of Hosea, I am your husband. Christ in the church, Christ and his bride. We're aiming for a wedding ceremony. We want to go to a marriage, right? That's what the whole book is about. Why a marriage? Why sexuality? Well, God says, I love you. And you go, well, you know what? You're an eternal, infinite, unchangeable being, perfected in all of your aspects. And you've lived forever. And I don't get that. I don't even know what it means for you to say you do anything. Tell you what, I'm going to create something in your world which will teach you about me. I'm going to create a metaphor. I'm going to create a picture so you can begin to understand who I am. This is what I want you to know about me. I love you. I love you the way that you love your spouse. That passion and desire is what I want you to know about me. In fact, that lies at the very heart of what we proclaim as Christians, that God is love, and that he loved us so much that the Father determined to give his Son so that he could undo the effects of our rebellion against him. He loves us before he sends the Son. He loves us to redeem us and to bring us into a covenant relationship with Him. So He gives us a covenant relationship between man and woman so that He can bring, so that we can fall into that relationship. We can have that desire and we can have a glimpse of how dearly He loves us. When Satan comes along and has the capacity to pervert that relationship, he destroys, or at least hopes to destroy, the ability for us to communicate the gospel. He does this in a number of ways, and one of them is he takes the word love, and love means sex. And who could be against love? So what you've done is, there's a little sleight of hand, it's a logical trick, it's called equivocation. I have a brother who's named Tim. The primary preacher at the church where I work is named Tim. The music pastor there is named Tim. The one who takes care of high school music is named Tim. The guy who's in charge of the computers at our church is named Tim. When I say Tim to my wife, first thing she has to say is, which one? You can use the same sound to refer to multiple things. You can use the word love to refer to different things. That sheet that I gave you shows you all of the ways in which the word love has been perverted in order to support sexual perversity. We'll go over that more next time. But I want you to see those four arguments that are on there are four ways to try to punch something in and justify sexual behavior. And it's typically done under the rubric of love. When you destroy the concept of love, being committed, covenant faithfulness, where a human being puts another human being ahead of themselves, you've destroyed the capacity to even say God loves you. When you destroy human sexuality, you begin to destroy the capacity to even use the words which relate to the gospel. Father, son, marriage. You can't have a father without a mother. You can't have a son without someone begetting another. You can't have a marriage without a husband and a wife. The sexual perversion which has been taking place has been going on now for years. The reason why it has become so obvious to us is because the Christian church failed to properly protect sexuality and marriage. We allowed that to take place in our churches. Marriage becomes degraded. Divorce becomes easier. Sex outside of a covenant relationship becomes normal. Most babies born now in the United States to women under the age of 30 do not have a father and mother who are married to one another living together in the home when the baby comes home. The fact that the culture has gotten there has said that sex is about something other than covenant faithfulness. As you'll see in that sheet, sex is about romance, or sex is about pleasure, or sex is about therapy, or sex is about a way to come into contact with the divine, rather than sex is about committed covenant faithfulness to display what it means to be made in the image of God and what it means to live in covenant faithfulness with another human being. We've lost the ability to use the word love rightly. And because of that, we've lost the ability to contend with homosexuality. You see, it's not just that there's a drip coming through the ceiling and now the water's finally started to land on our head. It's that there's been a torrent coming through the ceiling and some of the water finally got over and hit us in the couch. But the entire other room of the house is under 3 feet of water before we noticed. Does that make sense? You see, when we bring up homosexuality, the young man who's sitting there in that letter goes, "Why did you pick on that one? You permitted so much other sexual insanity. Why are you picking on homosexuals? What's wrong with gay people? What did they do that got your ire up? Geez, half the people in this church have been married and divorced, and their divorces were not on good biblical grounds." How can you accept those sorts of things? And why are you picking on them? We made a huge cultural error. We swallowed the culture on human autonomy. We allowed it to creep into more and more sexual arenas. And finally, it got to the place where it now becomes undeniable rebellion against the Creator. It becomes so obvious that even we can see it. But we have no ability to argue against it because we gave up all of the other ground. Hence, the reason why we're in the shape we are right now. So I'm going to stop at this point. Our time's up. So I just want you to get a big picture of this briefly. It's theology. It's rebellion against the Creator. It's denial of who we are as creatures. That denial of who we are as creatures is an act of rebellion against our Creator. It's a desire for human autonomy. That human autonomy is going to cover more and more space. It's going to pervert our ability to think and worship. We are going to worship the creature rather than the Creator. We are going to see ourselves as independent beings, and that's necessarily going to show up in how we interact sexually. Since we have an enemy, Satan, who is lying behind these things and who is drawing us on, he's going to do his best to distort the actual picture of who God is. He's going to distort our sexuality. He's going to distort our relationships. He's going to distort what we mean about love. It's going to lead to all manner of insanity when it comes to living as human beings. And it's going to result in us being bereft of the words necessary to communicate the gospel. This is an attack upon the gospel, but that also leads us to the answer, which we'll talk about next time, which is the gospel is the answer for this attack. With that, let's quit. I will pray, and then we will go to the next. Dear Father, I thank you for your love, for your goodness. I thank you for your gospel. I thank you, Father, that you loved us so that you gave us a picture of your love in marriage. That you gave us a picture and just the nature of the Trinity, that the Father loves the Son, and yet the Father and the Son and the Spirit sacrifice so that we may come to you. You have given your Son. The Son has given his life. The Spirit has brought us to the Son to glorify you. I ask that you care for those with whom we will speak, that we can rightly and well communicate the true love of God as found in Jesus Christ. Please give us wisdom and grace so that we can communicate your gospel rightly. Particularly, may our hearts be focused upon those who have fallen into the trap of being attracted to their own sex, to their hurt, and to the degradation of their status as being made in the image of God. Bless us and be with us in Jesus' name. Amen.